You're listening to Spice Radio 1200 AM's The Morning Buzz, and we are speaking to Margareta Dovgal, Managing Director at Resource Work Society. And this week's topic is a deep dive into the latest federal budget, plus why Scotland is rolling back its climate goals and whether there's a lesson in it for Canada. Margareta, thank you so much for joining us.
Good morning, Karen.
Awesome. So let's get into it. So what were the broad strokes of this week's federal budget tabled by Finance Minister Chrystia Freeland?
Well, in short, spending is going up, our debt servicing costs are also soaring, and entirely unsurprisingly, taxes are getting hiked too to pay for all of it. And in many ways, this is really the natural conclusion to questions that began to be asked really intensely during the pandemic about how we were going to afford all of the unprecedented borrowing. And keep in mind, during the pandemic, we didn't just spend like crazy in a bid to keep the economy afloat, but we also saw government revenues tank. So having easy access to credit, in a way, saved the day. Massive cash injections prevented Canadians from feeling the full brunt of the economic impact that was felt globally. And these economic stimulus programs ensured that businesses could keep more workers employed. They directed cash to those who were affected by job losses or reductions in income. Well, we're now well out of the pandemic, but that borrowing lives on in the form of a very hefty servicing cost in our federal budget. In fact, with interest rates as high as they are, it is so hefty that repayment of that debt exceeds all of the money spent by the federal government on health care, including transfers to provinces. So beyond repaying that borrowing, the total outstanding sum of which sits at a jaw-dropping $1.4 trillion, they're spending for new programs, and that is continuing to grow the overall impact of the budget. Some of these new programs include national dental care, pharma care, and investments in housing. So finding a way to pay for it has required the government to both borrow and also increase taxes, the characteristic angle to the latter here being taxing the wealthy. The part that's, I think, gotten the most attention with this budget cycle has been the change to the capital gains tax. And that's raising concerns kind of across the board that we're becoming further uncompetitive with other jurisdictions, sending entrepreneurs and innovators the signal that maybe they shouldn't bother with Canada. So lots of mixed messages, but I think for those who want to see more government programs, there is a sense of positivity from those folks as well.
Now, the next question is, you know, if you had to take a guess, what impact will this budget have on the federal Liberals' re-election odds?
Well, you know, I think there's broadly two schools of thought here on what we're observing and what intentions might lie behind it from a political perspective. All of this hinges on the expectation that this is a government that has been in office for quite some time. You know, change in a cyclical sense is very likely. You know, polling seems to indicate that at this point, the Conservatives have a fairly good chance to win the next federal election. But it's not a done deal yet. And, you know, things can change quite a bit in 1 year, assuming, of course, that's when the election takes place. The more cynical take overall behind this budget is that a late-term government that sees its odds of re-election narrowing is ultimately incentivized to win support wherever it can. And that includes spending and borrowing to direct dollars to popular programs, even when that spending and borrowing isn't necessarily sustainable or it saddles future governments and future taxpayers with pain. You know, that might save some seats for MPs. It will certainly put a successor government more prone to austerity approaches on the defensive even further, because they will be more likely to cut to bring spending into line. So if so, excellent setup for opposition messaging. There's a more charitable take here, that a late-term government elected on a socially progressive mandate is keen to deliver on the most ambitious and ultimately most expensive programs it sees as needed while there's still an opportunity to do so. They may also recognize that once large-scale programs are implemented, they're pretty hard to roll back or fully deconstruct by future governments. And there's a tactical angle to this, too. You know, terms of government between parties with opposing or contrasting ideology are a little bit like a negotiation or a tug-of-war over many years. You might bite off a very large chunk, whether that's spending, you know, social programs, certain types of cultural policy even, but only realistically expect a portion of those policies to survive into the long term. You know, it's hard to set something up. It's hard to roll something back. And that's the tug of war that we see between cycles of government in a democracy like ours. But I think the truth can absolutely be somewhere between these two scenarios. There's honest intentions here, programs that I think Liberals think are needed, and there's also political realism on, you know, where the polling is at and what typically happens when a government's been in power for many years. Based on what I'm seeing and hearing, like I said, I think a conservative win in the next election is more likely than ever before. But there's still a long runway to get there. And as it relates to other policy pieces within the budget, one thing that really caught my attention was the renewed attention being paid to housing. I think that's a positive sign. The Conservatives came in on this one pretty early on. They won quite a bit of support, Polyev in particular, by talking about just how unreasonable and unfair it is that entire generations have been priced out of the housing market. And it's not just for people who want to buy homes. It's hurting renters across the board, everywhere in the country. It took a little bit of time for the federal government to respond. Over the last couple of months, they've really been amping up their messaging, and this budget really cinches that. They want to get 4 million additional homes built in the next couple of years, at long last. As far as reactions from those in politics go, Pierre Poilievre, leader of the Conservatives, was keen to note that this is the ninth budget with a deficit. So we can expect that angle to continue in the next couple of months. And I think for Canadians who are feeling the pinch, those who, maybe in some sense of the word are better off, but still feeling the squeeze and now facing increased taxes, that message is going to resonate. Why do I have to pay for government's borrowing and spending irresponsibly? I think that's the message that the Conservatives want to resonate with their voting base. On the NDP side, their leader Singh said that there was not enough to tackle corporate greed in the budget. And, of course, this is a message that we've been hearing as it relates to grocery giants, for example, posting record profits while consumers are really feeling the pain when they go to checkout. But I think there's ultimately a valuable expression that comes to mind here. At a certain point, if you tax and spend, eventually you run out of other people's money. And if you're driving the people on who you rely to pay your bills out of the country, you may actually imperil your ability to keep supporting that spending. I think there's, unfortunately, a very pragmatic analysis that could be a problem for another government to solve. But I certainly hope that sustainability and just an honest assessment of what's going to be the impact on investment is being considered here as part of the rollout of this budget.
On the other side of the Atlantic, we've seen a fairly big policy reversal on climate action by the Scottish government. Please unpack that one for us.
Yeah, so last month there were reports that their government's ambitions to decarbonize the Scottish economy by 2030 were deemed no longer credible in the eyes of the UK Climate Change Committee. So the Scots actually rolled back their plan. Their new approach more closely resembles what the UK already does, five-year carbon budgets. And really what this boils down to is changing your economy, transforming it, isn't easy. It's very expensive, it's very time-consuming, and it requires a lot of coordination. Analysts are saying that, there's not enough ships, steel, or concrete available to the UK, certainly not enough skilled workers to build a lot of the renewable infrastructure that is needed to change their energy system. And overall, these supply chain constraints have made their ability to actually advance climate action as quickly and as ambitiously as planned a little bit less credible, or a lot more credible. But this isn't just specific to Scotland. The United Kingdom as a whole is facing a major net zero rollback. A senior government official actually said that the government will, quote, not save the planet by bankrupting the British people. And that's a pretty sizable shift backwards for the perspective of some climate commentators. And for those who want to see good, sustainable policy, maybe it's a recognition that if you want to take an ambitious and progressive course forward, you need to do it in a way that actually can be done. You don't lose public confidence and trust, and you don't set ambitious goals that are implemented unevenly, especially if you know that overall those goals are not achievable.
And are there any lessons here for Canada and BC?
Oh, certainly. First of all, don't bite off more than you can chew. Match your climate ambition to reality. Honestly assess what needs to change to reach your goals, how much it costs, how much time it takes, who's going to pay for it and how, and base your plans off of that, not just hopes and dreams. Yes, climate change is a crisis we need to address, and urgently, but it wouldn't be a crisis if solutions were easy to implement. And a balance needs to be struck between realism and good stretch goals. And there was a little bit of commentary that I wanted to share with you guys. Writing in the UK's Telegraph paper, Tom Harris said, quote, politicians have conspired over the years to pretend to their electors that net zero can be achieved with an entirely pain-free process, with no compromises on income, employment, or standards of living. Too many politicians, he says, were too unwilling to give voters the painful, uncamouflaged truth. how true is that? Not just for the United Kingdom, not just for the issue we're seeing in Scotland, but overall globally. I think there needs to be a reality check that comes into place and an attention to rising costs. That's the way you ensure people's well-being. It's the only way to advance climate policy sustainably. And mechanisms like revenue neutrality, you know, keeping track of all of the other policy measures the governments bring in, whether it's carbon taxes or taxes as a whole or red tape that make doing business difficult, keeping track of all of these things and the impact they have on people is integral to the role of a good government. And when you're trying to do something very difficult and costly, but necessary, like acting on climate change, you need to be mindful of all of these things and not be relying on fantasy economics and wishful thinking to get you across the line.
Margaret, as always, really appreciate your insights. Thank you so much. You take care.
You too, Karen.